Our parents tried to teach us that speed kills. In aviation, just the opposite may be true. I'm Paul Platt, and this is Aero News. Welcome in to the Aero News special feature. Thanks for downloading us today. My guest is Bob Miller of Over the Airwaves, the journalist for the Proficient Pilot. We'd like to get together with Bob on Mondays and talk safety issues, and this will be no exception. Bob, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure as always, Paul.
Let's talk about a couple of topics in the January edition of Over the Airwaves. The first one I wanted to bring up with you is your article on deadly yaw, and I wanted to ask you, when is slower not safer? I think I know intuitively a couple of the answers to that, but let's talk about what you were getting at with this article.
We have to determine at what phase of flight, or know at what phase of flight, the effects of yaw can have its greatest adverse effect on our airplane. And when we think about it, yaw is created by typically by drag produced by one or the other wing in a turn. And if we're flying at cruise speed and we just nudge the stick or the yoke one way or the other to lift a wing, the airplane will make typically a nice, smooth, coordinated turn with very, very little rudder input required, because there's very little drag on either wing that would produce the yaw. But as we slow, and if all of our listeners would think back to the time when they were a private pilot or student pilot practicing slow flight, one of the objectives that we instructors have in slow flight is to have the student feel how much additional control input is required to affect any change in flight attitude when we're flying slow as opposed to flying quickly. Now, we know through that experience that it takes a much larger aileron deflection to turn the airplane in slow flight, to bank the airplane in slow flight. Now, what happens when that aileron, let's say we're making a left-hand turn, just picture this with me, left-hand turn, so that we maneuver the aileron so that the outside or the right aileron is hanging down into the wind, and that forces that right wing up. Well, that down-turning aileron hanging into the wind like that has a much greater drag effect than it does when it's deflected minimally at higher speeds. So we have parasitic drag being impacted as a result of that downward deflecting aileron, and we also have induced drag as a result of the right wing developing more lift.
Right.
So, consequently, put those two forces together, we'll have much more of a yaw effect in slow flight than we will in higher speed flight.
And unfortunately, in a lot of propeller-driven aircraft, we have a number of different sources of yaw that add up, especially at low speed.
Well, sure. I mean, at low speeds, we have, if we're developing power, developing lift, we have the natural left-turning tendencies of the airplane as well that are exacerbating the problem. And where this all comes home to roost is the relative risks and resultant accidents that we face when engaged in what we call maneuvering flight. This is flight typically at slower air speeds in and around the traffic pattern. We're not accustomed to flying at low speeds like this, and unless we're keeping everything properly coordinated with adequate input on the rudders, this is where we get into accidents. And we know that other than landing accidents, landing while engaged in maneuvering flight is the next greatest source of accidents that we face. So this is evidence of the seriousness of this problem.
You know, I was thinking about that specifically, Bob. I think I've told you that before I ever started taking even ground school, I spent the better part of a year just reading the daily accident reports. And the thing that jumps out at you if you do that sort of thing is the number of accidents that happened, A, in the airport environment where speeds are down if you're in the pattern, and B, the number of stall spin accidents. And I think we often associate speed with danger in many aspects of our lives, certainly on the highway. And certainly there is some additional risk of serious injury in any vehicle that's moving fast just because of the deceleration forces involved if you hit something. But really, if we look at the accident statistics, slow flight is very, very dangerous compared to high-speed flight, and I think that maybe is lost on a lot of people.
Well, I think so. As Dick Van Grunsven said of the RV aircraft company, his experience when I asked him in an interview what he considers the greatest shortcoming among his customer pilots, and he, without hesitation, said maneuvering in slow flight. He said, typically, and think about this, after we pass our private pilot certificate, we are now a pilot. On a typical Saturday morning when we fly, we get in our airplane, we drive it to the down the taxiway, we drive it onto the active runway, we drive it down the runway, drive it into the sky, drive it through cruise, drive it through descent, landing, and we drive it back to the hangar. None of us have systematically, or very few of us systematically, practice slow flight maneuvering since the day we obtained our private pilot certificate. So now we have a whole cohort of pilots, many of us up there maneuvering now in and around the traffic pattern, who have no idea of what the added attendant risks are. And as a result, we do. We see them once a week in the United States, statistically. We have a fatal stall spin accident. That's about 50 of them every year. And why is this? Such a foolish way to die in an airplane in a stall spin when they are just so easily prevented.
Well, and we get into an argument now that I know you've had before, and that is with the FAA having eliminated any requirement for spin recovery training to get the private pilot certificate, all the emphasis now is on avoiding it in the first place. And
the argument that I know the folks over at Air Safety Foundation widely speak, and that is, you know, since most stall spin accidents occur in the traffic pattern where they're largely unrecoverable to begin with, why practice them? Well, I think the arguing point to that is, well, if we practice them at a safe, high altitude, I feel that we pilots will have a greater sense, almost a somatographic sense. That is, what our body senses are when we're about to enter a stall and when we're about to enter a spin. If we know what those senses are telling us, we can reestablish the proper attitude in the traffic pattern, thereby preventing the stall spin incident in the first place.
Well, I was going to say, an important part of avoiding a stall is knowing what it feels like when it's about to happen. And if all you do is avoid it, you may never sense that.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And here, avoidance is not a good thing. I think under proper supervision with adequate instruction at a safe altitude, I think every pilot, certainly, without question, every flight instructor has to go through spin training far more than the one or two turns that we flight instructors have to do as part of our training. We all should become proficient in that maneuver and understand what the aerodynamics of the spin is. Again, it's costing us 50 fatal flights a year. And it's something that alone should be sufficient justification for us all to be a little bit more aware of how they work.
My guest is Bob Miller of Over the Airwaves, the journal for the proficient pilot. We've been talking about low-speed accidents, and in a moment when we come back, I want to talk about the risks involved in one particular activity that can easily produce that very kind of accident. I'm Paul Plack. You're listening to a special feature from Aero News.
This is a story of two pilots. Our first guy, the one with Garmin Waas GPS, he just arrived home from a trip, ready to enjoy a nice home-cooked meal with his supermodel girlfriend.
Chérie, viens près de moi.
But our other guy, the pilot without Waas, well, he couldn't quite make it home. Had to divert to an airport with an ILS approach. So now it's dinner from a vending machine in some crummy pilot's lounge. You know which pilot you want to be. Garmin Waas GPS. Follow the leader.
Chérie.
At Cirrus Design, we don't ignore the fundamentals of aviation design. We just give them an ingenious new interpretation. The Cirrus SR20 G2. Interested in a substantial airplane that remains practical and affordable? Whether you're a non-pilot looking to begin flying lessons, a pilot needing personal transportation, or a fleet customer selecting the best plane to meet the demands of a multiple aircraft operation, consider the SR20 G2. To learn more, call 888-750-9927 or check us out on the web at cirrusdesign.com.
Welcome back to the Aero News special feature. I'm Paul Plack, talking today with Bob Miller of Over the Airwaves, the journal for the proficient pilot. And Bob, you mentioned in the January edition of OTA, one of the activities that I know has already caught the attention of insurance companies. And I know that I have seen situations where it has made people make some foolish decisions. Fortunately, in the cases of the ones that I've seen, they did not result in an accident. But aerial photography, obviously, this is one of the great benefits of general aviation aircraft. And we both know people who do this for a living. But I think if we're not accustomed to all the factors that go along with this, we may easily get into a situation like the ones we discussed in the first half of this interview.
Well, aerial photography has its own set of challenges. to the pilot. Now, first of all, we are typically engaged in an activity at relatively low altitude. Second, we're engaged in turning flight or steep banking turns at a low altitude. This alone is a handful for a pilot to be dealing with. And then adding that third requirement of aiming a camera out an open window on the airplane and catching our target and putting the camera into proper focus, that can be just enough to cause a cognitive overload, if you will, to the point that we're focusing, no pun intended, we're focusing on the camera rather than on operation of the airplane. Now, I have a dear friend, Jim Cavanaugh, professional aerial photography photographer, has his own Cessna 150, and he's able, and I've watched him do it. He's able to circle over a target, aim the camera, keep the aircraft under control, take a shot, and he does just fine. But he's a proficient, skilled pilot. If on the other hand, we have a professional photographer who's skilled at photography and minimally experience in the airplane, that's where we have a real reason to be wary of what problems might result.
I have seen this happen, Bob. I've seen this become a problem in flights in which it wasn't even the pilot taking the photographs. If you get somebody who is a camera buff and you take them up for, you know, maybe a flight in a general aviation aircraft, which they've never done before, they may be asking you to go slow. Hey, can you hover right here? Can you make a turn around this point?
Well, that's it. And the photographer is, you know, trying to point out what the target is on the ground below. And so the hapless pilot is focusing on the target rather than focusing on the airplane. It's a risky endeavor. And I think getting insurance, I've been told, as an aerial photographer can be just as expensive as getting insurance to become a pipeline observer or any other form of crop dusting, because the insurance companies do see this as a high attendant risk. I think if we have adequate training in aerobatics, I know my friend Jim Cavanaugh I mentioned earlier, he's been through extensive aerobatics, and he knows and he can feel and sense what the airplane is doing. The old phrase, flying by the seat of your pants, has indeed meaning, because you can feel whether an airplane, an experienced pilot, can feel when an airplane is yawing and when it's flying in a coordinated fashion. If you have those skills and you take adequate precautions to clear any kind of obstacles that may be in your area, get the airplane properly trimmed in the turn, and then once it's trimmed in the turn almost for hands-off flight, then position the camera, take your shot, and then come back to the airplane, then chances are it's going to all work out just fine. It's when our attention is diverted from flying the airplane, whether it's aerial photography or just simply talking with our passengers, that is when we typically have problems, when we divert our attention from the airplane. I go back to the sterile cockpit example that is required in airline operations, where nothing in the cockpit can be talked about except operation of the airplane for the first 10,000 feet.
Right.
There's good merit to that.
Well, I guess if you do want a picture of that scenic area near your home or of your home itself, at least get someone to come with you and take the pictures.
Yeah, or fly the airplane. There's one function, and then there's the other function. It takes a high level of piloting proficiency, I believe, to do both safely.
All right, Bob. Well, listen, as always, we appreciate these Monday chats. We'll look for another one next week.
Thanks, Paul. Talk to you.
You can find out more about Bob Miller and Over the Airwaves, the Journal for the Proficient Pilot, at overtheairwaves.com. You've been listening to a special feature from Aero News. Find us on the web at www.aero-news.net. I'm Paul Platt. Thanks for listening. Have a clear and unlimited day.